cryptids. Let's get Bill McDonald's take on these strange creatures in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Bill McDonald with us. Bill, I remember talking with you about some of the work of Steve Alton. You did a number of research projects with him. I'd love his theories about the Loch Ness Monster, don't you?
Well, once upon a time, I told Steve a story back in 2002 about a very unique group of pets that I had in a bunch of fish tanks. And those were anguilliform eels. Now, the anguilliform eels include some of your saltwater morays. Mm-hmm. They include your congers, which are also saltwater in the North and Central Atlantic. And it also includes all of those eels that like to go up rivers and live in lakes and everything in North America, New Zealand, Europe, Eurasia. These eels do everything. They travel everywhere. They can even travel over land. They use their swim bladders like a modified lung. And they can even feed on land if they get larger. And the neat thing about having the Loch Ness Monster or Champ or Ogopogo or Ishi or any of these famous lake monsters is that you do not need a breeding population. You don't need a sustainable breeding population because they already exist. They are a family of related individuals of known species that exist in all of these famous waterways. And eels are the most fabulously amazing fish that have evolved. They have been around since Jurassic times as far as the body form itself. But the nature of anguilliform eels, they're products of evolution because of 14 ice ages over a 2.5 million year period. Like salmon, like trout, they are fishes that evolved because of the ice ages, and they're very advanced. And they are more, their bodies are more dexterous than snakes. They can rip prey apart spinning like a crocodile does. I'm sure you're familiar with the death roll that crocodiles, alligators, yeah, and all crocodilians do when
they grab their prey.
When they grab their prey, they roll. Well, eels do it faster. The small ones spin as fast as the blades on any of your boat engines. They spin as fast as propellers. And as you know, Jeremy Wade, who is an actual fish biologist, who's also an extreme angler.
He's the river monsters guy,
he's
right?
The river monsters guy. He started finding fish, catfish, carps, perch, eels, electric eels, which actually are knife fish. They're not even real eels. And I've had a bunch of them as pets, too. And they also breathe air. And a wide variety of sharks and a wide variety of other fish that have the ability to swim in both seawater and freshwater, and they're big enough to eat people. And he defines, you know, a river monster as basically a fish that can eat a person, whether it's a kid or a small adult or even a larger adult. And eels fulfill all of this in an amazing way. And we used eels as Loch Ness Monster for Steve Alton because when I went up there, I've made four trips to Loch Ness in my life. First was in 1993. Then I made one in 2004, one in 2005 for Steve. And then I've had one trip since. And I was able to confirm with every trip multiple locations where the eels are there year round. Now, that means that they can go for up to 6 months in ice-cold 42-degree water without eating at all. Then when the salmon and the trout and the Arctic char come back into the lake before dispersing up the various rivers into the highlands to breed, they gorge feed. Now, only a fish can do that. Reptiles and mammals in cold water require enormous amounts of food because they have to produce heat. Fish do not. and most reptiles do not, except that we know that certain kinds of dinosaurs and perhaps certain marine reptiles may have been endotherms, able to create their own internal body heat the way dolphins and whales do. They would have had to maintain blubber. It would have been reptilian blubber, but it would have been body fat the same way that mammals do, convergent evolution, if you will. But in cold water, they have to eat. And if they have to eat constantly, they can't go on long diets. And then they're going to be seen, and then they're going to be hunted by the tribesmen that live in the area. And these predators are going to become chow for the primitive tribes and some of the highlanders that live in that area.
I'll eat a little sushi once in a while, Bill, but what I will not eat is eel.
Eel's delicious.
I won't
Mostly
do it.
It's cooked. But it's utterly delicious, and you can dip it in every kind of sauce imaginable.
So how big is the Steve Alton eel?
Well, the Steve Alton eel started at about 16 feet, which was the beginning of what we call the Guyver stage.
And they have this hump look in the water?
Well, now that's a very interesting thing. How do you get an eel to make a hump? Well, we had 6, 7, even 100, and even 1,000 gallon aquariums at the various pet stores that were owned by Larry Lou and Jerry Russo and Danny Giacomo back in the 70s. There was a pet chain in California that I worked for, and the eels would go and they would gulp air, or they would grab a spot of food, and then they would rotate back downward, but the entire ribbon-like length of the body would rotate into that same spot where the head had gone before the animal had surfaced and then dived. And then as the animal continued to dive, the body would continue to roll into this hump, and it would be rotating. And the hump would be moving across the surface until the tail was done, and then the whole animal was submerged again. And this long ribbon-like rolling process with the larger eels that we had that I maintained in koi ponds with very large koi, which are carp, by the way, they would do the same thing, but you'd get two humps and sometimes even a third hump briefly. Now, the native squats, when they see something right at the break of dawn or on a very foggy or very overcast day, they don't see a swan neck ever. What they see is humps in the water, or they see a fish with a head like a horse crawling around on the land in the dead of night, in the dead of winter. Now, if you look very carefully at that eel drawing that I have loaned to coasttocoastam.com from alienufoart.com, which right. is our website.
That's how we all first met.
Exactly. You'll notice that there is an eel on land, and the fisherman is lighting a cigarette, and the eel's hunting him. That's because eels can function like snakes on dry land. And if you look at the shape of that animal's head, and if you look at the texture of the dorsal fin up back behind the head, that's where you get that old legend of the water horse. Because an eel's head from certain angles does kind of look like the head of a horse in poor light, except it's a lot more smooth. Eel skin, they have tiny, tiny scales. They're almost microscopic. So the skin of an eel looks as smooth as the skin of a dolphin. And the dorsal fin, the ribbing on the dorsal fin, can look like strands of hair or knots of hair that functions as a horse's mane. And again, in very poor light from certain angles, you're going to get that. Now, if the anguilliform eel that went into the Guyver stage, and they're always female, is a conger who has managed to convert herself from salt water into fresh water, then the fin is closer to the head. If it is an anguilla, the fin is further back, about midway back along the dorsal ridge of the back. And again, it's a subject of angle, but the shape of the head and the shape of the face and the biology is the same in all of them. And those swim bladders are like lungs, and between the function of the gills and the function of the swim bladder, some eels can crawl on land and stay out of water for days at a time. There is documentation that one eel was able to make it overland from one water source to another over a two-week period in Central Asia. So, and they slithered like snakes.
They do. That's right.
Yeah.
Sideways.
Now, some eels climb dams, and those same eels can go into trees after a land food source.
And they climb up the tree?
Yes. Just like a snake.
They just shiver up, just like snake would. Okay. Curl around it and everything.
Especially if it's a pine that has lower branches.
How long can they stay out of the water?
Well, it was like I was saying, there's records of one that was out of water for 2 weeks because its body slime kept it moist.
Not longer?
I don't think so. In fact, other than that one situation where the weather probably contributed to the animal's survival, and remember, they do well in extreme cold. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. But even morays, which are harder to keep than any of the other anguilliforms, if you're catching them commercially down in Florida or some places, and you have like an oversized green moray, roughly the size of, you know, maybe 5-6 foot eel, they might thrash around on the deck of the boat in the sun for hours and hours.
Jeez,
and hours.
Unlike a fish that would die relatively soon, this thing will still be there.
And biting on you.
Yeah.
And once they lock on you, and that's the other thing about these eels, they have a secondary set of jaws that evolved from gill rakers that can literally shove forward to grab your hand or the prey animal from the back of the throat to pull it deeper into the mouth. And all of the teeth are pointed backwards, and whether the teeth are only a millimeter long,
they're like razors, aren't they?
Or not razors, they're the sharpest they're the sharpest pinpoint item in nature. The only thing that comes close to matching the sharpness of an eel's tooth is the harpoon on certain species of snails, which are mollusks.
They could tear you apart.
Well, those harpoons envenomate you. It's a very horrible death by venom.
Let's take a few calls.
Species of snails that can actually lance you. But eel teeth are very much like that, and they point backwards. It's called a distal curve. And I did a lot of research on eel teeth with Steve Alton back when he was writing The Lock.
He brought one of these eel heads in to show us. It was a model?
That was based on my research.
Okay.
Contributions of about 4 or 5 other people.
Well, let's go to Henning in Clayton, Indiana, first-time caller. Hey, Henning, welcome to the show.
Thank you, George.
Sure thing, sir.
I have a question for the gentleman in the studio.
Okay.
My wife is telling me that these ETs, the gray aliens, which is visiting here on Earth in the craft, that they are actually cybernetic organisms, just like the cyborgs as we see in Star Trek. And that's why they are shaped like they are, because of the deficiency of the muscles and so on. But they are a cybernetic organism. Could you elaborate on that?
All right.
Well, basically, you're correct, but those spacefaring species have been spacefaring for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So it's no longer about deficiency. It's about adaptation. Body fat and large mass in microgravity and synthetic and artificial environments is a detriment. And so you would adapt to being exceedingly skinny. And in artificial environments where there are no sharp edges, you could evolve larger eyes that would allow you to see in more broad spectrums, especially if they're cybernetically enhanced through nanotechnology or through surgical means, such as bionics that Martin Kaden used to talk about that became Universal Television's $6 million man back in the 70s and early 80s. And so that would be an adaptation at that point. With us, it would be a detriment. But with spacefaring species that are far older, it has become an adaptation, an evolutionary adaptation. The artificial constructs that are introduced to their bodies at the time that they are gestated would be something that enhances their physiology and gives them longevity because they've become dependent on their non-organic components to support the chemistry and the functions of their living tissues at the molecular level. Does that help you at all?
I think it did. And I think his wife was spot on. And speaking of wives, your wife, does she still work in the ghost arena?
She certainly does. My wife is, I don't know how to describe her except to say she's Bravo Housewife hot. And she is a ghost hunter who is a detective and a photographer, but she also has medium abilities and psychic abilities that I have not chosen to develop. So while I'm very nuts and bolts in my detective work, she practices old-fashioned gumshoe detective work plus internet detective work with spiritual mediumship, which is something that I know that you're intimately familiar with and that you understand far better than I. And I just think that her interest in working with police officers and firemen and emergency medical technicians who have attempted to generate documentation because of bizarre paranormal incidents that occurred on calls that either got them in trouble or didn't get them in trouble. My wife has decided to focus her research on cases involving emergency personnel and police.
Excellent.
We had a case in Arizona. I can't say the city. I can't say who the officers are, but they were, you know, post-certified, academy-accredited.
The real deal.
Police officers.
Yeah.
Working for a city that had more than its fair share of politics. And in order to protect them, we sanitized everything that would identify the victim, that would identify the city, the agency, or the officers themselves. And we protected their identities. And they trusted us not to mess them over that way. And we published that. And there is a link at alienufoart.com. This is Lori's most intriguing ghost case, and that is the rape of a female who comes from a very religiously repressive part of the world in Asia, who was attacked by an invisible entity, sexually assaulted, and then when the police and the firefighters and the EMS personnel arrived, they got pushed and shoved around by invisible forces. They had the hair pulled. They had their vehicles pounded on.
And this is all documented.
And this is all documented. We have a police report on our website right now that people can go to, and they can read it for themselves. Now, we've redacted anything that would get those officers either identified or in trouble.
I understand. I understand.
And that's what you have to do, you know, with your brothers and sisters in law enforcement. You can't break the faith with them. This is just like Leonard Stringfield not breaking the faith with the military doctors that described the Roswell aliens
That's
to
right.
him.
And he got great information that way.
He sure did. And that upset a lot of other researchers. But I got to tell you, Len Stringfield, he taught me long before I actually, you know, took on, you know, the badge myself. But he said, you do not mess your witnesses.
He was one of the good guys, Bill. We're going to come back. We're going to take some final phone calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll have open lines for you next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Lots going on, but when we come back with Bill McDonald, more of your calls and more of ghosts on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Bill, before we take more calls with you, tell me more about Lori's work then with law enforcement and what she needs. Maybe we can help.
Well, we are putting out the call for any individuals in public service who have either wished to document or actually attempted to document through, you know, the standard IRDR documentation, incident report process, anything of a paranormal nature. And if they got in trouble, if they're worried about, you know, keeping their confidentiality, Lori is as careful with their identities as if it was a member of our own family. And she treats it like a medical situation, like HIPAA, you know, that law that protects the
That's
privacy
right.
of medical people. So if they want to trust a law enforcement family with information regarding any kind of paranormal or haunting event that they encountered during their regular service or shift, we would love to document that and build a database on that we would share with everybody, you know, the way we do all of her ghost research at alienufoart.com. The other thing that Lori is really concerned about is that we develop the science behind ghosts. There has to be a physics.
And somebody's got to start doing that.
And we as a family are definitely making progress in that area. I've even talked to physicists like my father, Hal Puthoff, and a lot of other people regarding the human soul as a complex matrix of organized patterns of potential energy, which is identity. Identity can never be created or destroyed. It's information. It can only change form, but it cannot be lost except under certain circumstances, like a cosmic disaster or being inside a nuclear blast or something like that, where the information may randomize and be irrecoverable because of sufficient force applied. But we absolutely believe that human beings go on living after their bodies are no longer able to host their life force. Where they go, a lot of that is up to them. Lori believes that as you experience and gain experience living, that is the fuel that allows for your identity to, it's the boost to make the quantum leap to the next level of existence, whatever that is. And so she is into the spiritual for that reason, because she wants to prove that there is life after death. And just like that one case where there was a five-year-old that was responding to questions from family members of a World War II pilot whose aircraft went down or was shot down over the Pacific, which is an example of a proof of life after death. Lori wants to do it, but in a ghost or a haunting venue. And interestingly enough, some of the environments I work in are some of the most haunted environments anywhere. So she's looking to gain access to some of those venues as well.
Okay, let's take a call or two here. Let's go to Gary, Houston, Texas. Gary, thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Sure.
Two quick questions. The you talked a lot about the physiology aspect of traveling in space, but the human body, the only cell that doesn't reproduce is the brain cell. So, you know, how would you deal with that?
Not true. Brain cells do reproduce. That's new information that's been around since 2003.
Okay,
brain cells do reproduce, but they reproduce more slowly and they're more precious and in smaller numbers than generalized stem cells or stem cells that then dedicate themselves to specific organs or functions. But
if there's hope for us then.
Yeah.
The second question I had was about your constitution question, your belief in our government, and right now in their election in particular. The SEIU is paying people to go to the Republican rallies and protest, act like protesters. So I'm kind of worried about our government. I'm just going to hang up and let you talk about why you have so much faith in it. But it's growing too fast, and I'd just like your opinion on why you're so confident that we can trust our government.
Okay, you got it.
Okay, George, that's very simple. I have spent extended periods of time in over 18 different foreign countries, and I've been around the world three times in my life. And the system that is the most nurturing to its people continues to be our own. There's just no other way to put it. You go anywhere else, the conditions are more repressive to varying degree. The amount of legislation is more draconian. The rules and regulations are more intense, and the personal freedoms are reduced to varying degrees. It's only in the United States of America that you have the most amount of freedoms that are available on this planet.
Bill,
liberty still exists.
You sent in a couple images to us, the briefing, the party crasher. Can you explain what those are?
Yeah, those are combinations of spacecraft beings and life forms and environments inside spacecraft described by multiple persons who are in the law enforcement profession. In other words, when I have some downtime and I review my notes that I've taken from my conversations with numerous law enforcement persons who believe that they were abducted, or I have this one case here in the Southwest where a law enforcement officer, along with his sister and his mother and father, they were abducted throughout their entire lives. And they even took a family vacation under the influence of their abductors to the top of the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan in Mexico. But I take the elements from various law enforcement personnel's descriptions, and I made these drawings. And I they started as doodles, but then they became more intense. And it was just downtime between assignments. And I just ended up loving them so much that I decided to share them with everybody.
Okay, let's go next to Monty in Boise, Idaho. Welcome to the show. Hi, Monty.
Hey, guys.
Good to have you with us.
I hope everyone's well tonight.
Yes, we are. Clicking along.
Okay, well, Bill, you're scatting all over the place, and I like this because last night we have Dr. Brian Weiss on, and it's interesting to me that you could tie in, well, not you, but you're talking about the eels and explaining how you need to sit down with Brian Weiss and talk to him about talking to these other people that have past life regression and into areas where timeline-wise, I've got a girlfriend that swears to God that she, through meditation, was with dinosaurs.
Well, your girlfriend needs to contact my wife because that's more her bailiwick.
Okay, well,
Lori's expertise is in areas like that. And, of course, I like to watch her work, and I learn a lot by doing so. And I suggest that you have your girlfriend.
What's your email?
Yeah,
what is that email for you?
The email is alienufoart,
A-R-T,
at tux.net. But the easiest way is to go to any page at alienufoart.com and just click on any of the email buttons.
Simple as that.
It's as simple as that.
What do you do next? What's on your plate these days?
Well, I am writing science fiction, and I've completed a number of manuscripts for a series of short stories that are connected. And I have also, and it's all based on my research, and it's about, if you remember Chris Carter's syndicate that was controlling the secret of UFOs and aliens in the old X-Files, well, my sci-fi is about this Scottish clan that's actually their bosses. A group of brothers, cousins, sons, and fathers, all of whom actually administrate the secret of UFOs and alien technologies and all of that at the very top. The special access program that functions as a multinational corporate conglomerate that is a cabal that is untouchable and answerable to no one. And it's about how absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's just some fun, fun, fun short stories. And everything is predicated on my actual research. And I found that it's just a more fun way to communicate these concepts than to try to write a nonfiction book that some people might find otherwise to be some dry reading.
You know, when we talked earlier about the Federation and the fact that we should all go into space as a unit, much like Star Trek and what they did. Is that realistic? Do you think it could happen?
It could absolutely happen because the science of the propulsion and the life support is all there. Humans probably will, by necessity, evolve to be more cooperative even than they have in order to build farming cultures from what it otherwise been egalitarian hunter-gatherer societies, where less development and less cooperation was required, and also less effort in child rearing. I think that as our world becomes more complicated and as resources become more finite, we're going to have to develop those kinds of cooperations that Gene Roddenberry dreamed about and back when he was alive. So yeah, but nobody is going further than Mars unless they have nanotechnology operating in their bodies and automated medical devices similar to what Larry Niven envisioned, you know, his famous autodocs, to further enhance and reprogram those nanites as they continue to do their maintenance work inside human bodies.
I bet we would get volunteers even if it was a one-way trip.
Oh, no question. Absolutely no question you'd get volunteers. The problem would be finding qualified volunteers.
True. True. Next up, east of the Rockies, Sean in Troy, Ohio. Hey, Sean, go ahead.
Yes, hi there.
Good
Thanks
to have you
for having me on.
Sure thing.
My question to your guest, great show, by the way, is if a computer was to equal or surpass the number of connections that the human brain has, could it then possibly become sentient?
The answer is yes. The problem, and the internet, even though you're thinking more in terms of hardware, I think, than software, the plain fact is that through the concept of distributed processing, sentience can be supported, but without the consequences if you were to combine the artificial intelligence into one single node or unit with one processor. That, I think, was the warning that Arthur C. Clarke was trying to give us with the HAL 9000.
Oh, okay. Thank you. By the way, I'm in law enforcement as well, and love it.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for your service. Are you a military veteran?
He's moved on.
Okay.
Most law enforcement are military veterans.
Not as much as they used to be. We got a lot of young kids coming in now.
They go straight into law enforcement.
Yeah, a lot of them have chosen that as opposed to military service. But I have to tell you, their learning curve is a lot more rocky without that military background, in
my opinion.
That's
true. Let's go to Rachel in California. Hey, Rachel, go ahead. You're on with Bill McDonald.
George, I just wanted to share, I am a retired law enforcement officer.
Okay.
And I did actually happen to be in the military, too. And although my experience I wanted to share isn't about UFOs, I was working one night and saw a huge, I mean huge, ball of fire coming towards the earth. And then just, poof, it disappeared. And I actually put it out on the air, on my radio. And said, who just saw that? To see if any of my partners would answer up. And one of, I think he was probably the most senior officer who'd been working, actually confirmed he just saw that too. And all the dispatchers just went nuts when I went in the station, wanted to hear about it. Very strange. I can't explain it, but I haven't really tried to investigate it myself because I think it's unexplainable.
Under Ronald Reagan and President George H.W. Bush, fireballs like what you're describing had a nickname in the military-industrial complex and in the Air Force. They were called fast walkers. That might be a term that George is familiar with
Sure.
from the old days. Fast walkers were unknown aerial objects that appeared to be under intelligent control that entered the atmosphere at extreme speeds. At night and in low light conditions, if these things are exhibiting the kind of toroidal energy fields that you would expect from anti-gravity, from an expression of anti-gravity science, and they hit the atmosphere fast, the air pressure impacts with that field, and it burns very, very hot, even though there is nothing ablating from the vehicle itself. It is just this infinitely hard field slamming into the atmosphere at high speed. The faster the speed, the more white the light. The slower the speed, the more orange or reddish it gets. And so that is simply something diving into the atmosphere very quickly before darting away at slower speeds to where the ionization effect is no longer visible in the air mass.
Time for one more question, Rob in Los Angeles. Go ahead, Robbie. Are we going to get you?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Just a little bit. You're breaking up a little bit. Go ahead.
There we go. Is that better?
Go ahead.
All right, cool. So I just tuned in a little bit ago now, so I missed some of Bill's earlier statements, but I do have one thing to comment on about him saying that the U.S. government is nurturing, and I love the UFO stuff. I love the ghost stuff. There's no proof for anything, so it's all still very much up in the air and subjective, and I love discussing it. But to say that the U.S. government's nurturing to its citizens, I just kind of find almost ludicrous. I mean, everything from foreign policy, domestic policy, education, economic, social, you know, status, they're very much aimed towards a specific, you know, percentage of the population that favors the wealthy, favors, you know, rich white men working in banks instead of, you know, the underprivileged.
Sir, may I make a comment?
Yeah, make your comment, and we're almost out of time, Bill.
I'm not really big into politics, but pick somewhere else in the world and try living there for 5 years, and then tell me how you feel after that. I did it, and that's why I love my country.
I love my country, too. Might not be happy with some of the people in government either way, but I love our country. And that's the name of the
game. If we want better representation, we need to groom them at the local level and then push them along into higher and higher levels of
office. And watch them. Make sure they don't get corrupted.
It's our own fault for not participating in the political process if we end up with not so great choices.
Bill, good luck in everything you do. Say hi to your wife, Lori, for us, okay?
Absolutely. And anybody who wishes to contact us, any book publishers out there or book agents, contact us via our Alien UFO Art website. That's alienufoart.com. You can get us there very easily. We're always there.
Super. Bill McDonald. Up next, open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Lots going on. Get ready to let your fingers do the walking. We'll be back with your calls next.